Hey listeners, if you're working on a manuscript, we'd love to help. Email us about our novel mentorship program at napleswritersworkshop@gmail.com. Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
All right, so it's your turn. Tell us about your story.
I picked a story by Dennis Johnson called Work, which is also from his Jesus' Son collection. We already did Car Crash While Hitchhiking. Wayne cradled his burlap sack of tools in his lap as we drove out of town to where the fields bunched up into hills and then dipped down toward a cool river mothered by benevolent clouds. All the houses on the riverbank, a dozen or so, were abandoned. The same company, you could tell, had built them all and then painted them four different colors. The windows in the lower stories were empty of glass. We passed alongside them, and I saw that the ground floors of these buildings were covered with silt. Sometime back, a flood had run over the banks, canceling everything. But now the river was flat and slow. Willows stroked the waters with their hair. Are we doing a burglary? I asked Wayne. You can't burglate a forgotten empty house, he said, horrified at my stupidity. I didn't say anything. This is a salvage job, he said. Pull up to that one, right about there. The house we parked in front of just had a terrible feeling about it. I knocked. Don't do that, Wayne said. It's stupid. Inside, our feet kicked up the silt the river had left here. The watermark wandered the walls of the downstairs about 3 feet above the floor. Straight, stiff grass lay all over the place in bunches, as if someone had stretched them there to dry. Wayne used a pry bar, and I had a shiny hammer with a blue rubber grip. We put the pry points in the seams of the wall and started tearing away the sheetrock. It came loose with a noise like old men coughing. Whenever we exposed some of the wiring in its white plastic jacket, we ripped it free of its connections, pulled it out, and bunched it up. That's what we were after. We intended to sell the copper wire for scrap. By the time we were on the second floor, I could see we were going to make some money, but I was getting tired. I dropped the hammer, went to the bathroom. I was sweaty and thirsty, but of course the water didn't work. I went back to Wayne, standing in one of two small empty bedrooms, and started dancing around and pounding the walls, breaking through the sheetrock and making a giant racket until the hammer got stuck. Wayne ignored this misbehavior. I was catching my breath. I asked him, "Who owned these houses, do you think?" He stopped doing anything. "This is my house." "It is?" It was. He gave the wire a long, smooth yank, a gesture full of the serenity of hatred, popping its staples and freeing it into the room.
So, what'd you like about this story, or had you read it before? What made you pick it?
What made me pick it was, there's a project I want to work on, and I'm trying to figure out what a good voice for this story is going to be. And I was thinking, oh, Dennis Johnson. I saw his name, I was flipping through a book, and I'd read some other stories, and I was like, I don't want to bring them. So I was flipping through the book, and I was like, oh, Dennis Johnson, because it's first person, it might be an interesting voice to think about. And so I read it, and it's like, let's do it for the podcast.
It's funny that you started with that, because I'm also working on a short story, and I had the idea, and I remember thinking, oh, this will be so exciting and fun to write. And then pretty quickly, it was just my own voice again. And I keep going back to it and thinking of like ways to like infuse what feels to me like just a really fun way of writing that makes for really fun reading. Feels like there's no rules in the way he's deciding to make the story come across. And then it, of course, like also mimics the character's mindset, which is just this drug-induced high and then haze. And then, I mean, he's on a roller coaster of substances throughout the story, right? And it takes him all those different places, but it also kind of frees up his brain to think of things in different ways. Capturing that is hard. I just talked in the newsletter about how I stopped reading a book that was essentially a point of view of a character who was in a drug-induced haze for months.
Oh, yes.
And yeah. There are paragraphs that I did not understand, but I don't think the point was to understand them. And I think some people enjoy some of that kind of reading and writing. But what I like about the two stories that we've read from this guy is that you're not necessarily lost completely in the plot. You might wonder about like a character's motivation, or, you know, they're talking about this is a salvage job. So you have questions about the validity of what's going on here, right? Maybe these narrators aren't totally reliable and the other characters could be lying about things or whatever. But you pretty much have like a grasp on physically where they are and sort of what they're doing. And the language and the drugs are mostly an effect on the character's interpretation of these scenes, but not to like the detriment of the reader. I don't know if any of this makes sense, but I've read stories where I'm like, I think they want me to feel like I'm also high, and that's not fun to read.
Car Crash was more like that, I feel. I didn't reread that. I should go back and reread that one. But this one is more cogent in some ways, like in the main part of it when they're doing the work, the titular work. And part of that is like, he even says he's like sweating out all the inebriants.
Impurities,
Yeah. And he threw up a little bit of gray something in the corner at one point. And so
bile,
he's not as affected in this moment.
right.
So it's an interesting clarity to it compared to other, like the beginning section when he's doing things, you're like, he just like gets mad and gets on a bus and like gets in a fight with those guys. Is it his wife that leaves with a bunch of guys after he hit her in the stomach and then she came back and then they were like, anyway, all of that is told in this kind of like foggy way. But then this main section is more clear. And then when they start drinking at the end after getting their $28 from the copper, then it kind of slides into a little more.
Yeah, even before then, I mean, I know his high's wearing off while they're doing the work. He talks about, like, this work is too hard. I don't feel high anymore. But it's in that section of the story where they see the woman on the kite and then they go and visit the wife afterwards. And those are other examples of, like, what's going on here? Like, did he really see the wife on the kite? Is this really her? He says something like, I know who she is. I saw her. And Wayne is just gives him this blank look. And then there's lines. He's not sure if he's in Wayne's dream or if they're having a dream together or if this is like a shared reality, but he doesn't really care because it's the best day ever. So there's sections like that where you're just, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. But like you said, there's enough here to like hold on to where I'm along for the ride that he's also having versus like I'm not just supposed to feel like confused and spun out the whole time I'm reading.
Oh, that's interesting. I was taking that dream stuff as being kind of more metaphorical because they had this experience together of stripping this house and then seeing this woman flying through the air. And then he wasn't part of the conversation that Wayne had with her. He said he like deliberately stepped away so he couldn't listen. Like, because at the end, he's like, that was her, right? Or was that her? And they both know who what he's talking about. So it's like this shared kind of moment. That's how I kind of took that dream thing to be more metaphorical.
He talks about watching them have the conversation. And then he says, I knew who she was. That was her, wasn't it? I said. Wayne was speechless. There was no doubt in my mind. She was the woman we'd seen flying over the river. As nearly as I could tell, I'd wandered into some sort of dream that Wayne was having about his wife and his house, but I didn't say anything more about it. Because after all, in small ways, it was turning out to be one of the best days of my life, whether it was somebody else's dream or not. We turned in the scrap wire for $28 each at a salvage yard near the gleaming tracks at the edge of town and went back to the vine. Yeah, it does seem metaphorical too.
Yeah, like Wayne is having a moment. He's like, I gotta go back to my own house. It was destroyed in a flood. I gotta rip out the wire. And then my wife is flying naked over over the neighborhood. And I gotta go talk to her. And the narrator's in just along. He's just there with them. This is totally Wayne's moment, but he gets to be there. But it's turning out to be a pretty good day for him. So yeah, so that's how I took.
That makes sense. I guess the way it's described, our main character is seeing this kite with this woman, and he doesn't know what to make of it. And then he sees the woman herself, and he also sort of doesn't know what to make of it. And because he's, like you said, maybe he's just like totally along for the ride. He has no stressors today, except that he's being told he'll make a little bit of money, which is why he's there, you know, he's game.
Yeah.
But he's just kind of floating throughout the afternoon, and maybe that's why he's not thinking too hard or worried too much about what's happening. And that's a good way to think about it being a metaphor for a dream. But I guess as a reader, up until that point, what we know about our narrator is that he's high and he's sort of unreliable. And so I don't know if what he's seeing is what he really saw. And I don't know if the woman that he's seeing is really the woman that was on the kite. You know, I'm also trying to understand how reliable he is in terms of telling us what he's experiencing, even. So, like, I also read that, like, I don't know.
I read it because he talked to Wayne about it. It wasn't a hallucination, right?
No.
But the other thing is the narration, like he as the narrator gets to tell us what happened. So he doesn't ever mention his own misgivings. He doesn't even make the connection in the narration. It's in dialogue. He's like, that was her. And like Wayne didn't even say anything. And
No, he
so
just looks at him.
he doesn't tell us that he has any feeling about this at all. So that's one way in which he feels detached from it. There's an interesting thing about stories like this, though, is the general detachment that I think is part of the voice that I first mentioned is we do not get the emotions. And this isn't unique to Dennis Johnson. This is like a genre of voice. I feel like it's very much latter 20th century, this era. He's probably just a very good example of it. But you feel it in a lot of different stories where you get a narrator who will just tell us what happens without expressing anything, any feelings about it. And there's a question of whether those feelings are unstated, where we're kind of expected to fill them in, or if the character really is unfeeling in those moments. I don't know what the answer to that is.
I feel like here, because of what we do know about what's happening for him today, he's out there to make money. He's just kind of along for the ride. Like, his feeling might just be like wonder and awe and curiosity. And that might be like enough
Not
of an
even,
emotion
I'm not,
versus
I mean,
like,
just that moment. I'm talking about the whole thing. Like, even he has no feelings about his wife when he punched her in the stomach, right? Because I feel he's less inebriated while he's doing the work than he is in the other moments. The only real feeling he kind of expresses is like appreciation for the server who gives him a good pour.
He does have a moment at the beginning when they take his wife, you know, they cart her off to safety. He says, "I don't remember what I said to them. I remember loneliness crushing first my lungs and my heart, then my balls. They put her in the car with them and drove away."
Yeah, and he acts on emotions. When he gets on the bus, it's out of certain feelings. I think I got sidetracked to the emotion thing because I was talking about detachment, the idea of detachment, not emotions themselves.
Yeah, like we said, I'd have to reread the crash story as well to remember exactly what it was like reading that. But I do know that I had to read that one at least twice to fully understand the plot of the crash itself and sort of even to visualize the scene after the fact, right? Like, I remember them like on the side of the road and
It was a little
okay,
more
which
jumpy.
vehicle stopped?
It was like flashbulb kind of moments. We might have even specifically said flashbulb moments in that episode, but.
But that one especially, I remember like sort of being told as if he himself were trying to remember so that he could tell you. It's like he's trying to make sense of what he experienced or saw or is experiencing or seeing so that he can convey it to you. And I think like that's an important part of what makes these like drug-induced stories worth my time. Sometimes you read them, and like I said, this book that I was reading, it didn't feel like it wanted to be understood. So I can enjoy and understand stories like Work, where he's doing his best to convey to us what this day was like. He wants us to understand. And so it makes these sort of things in moments where he kind of drifts off and gets super creative and makes a metaphor. It makes those feel more like these gold coins than tangents, you know? They feel like, oh, he's in a bit of a reverie right now, and it might be the result of whatever substance he's on, but he's also getting to something, you know? He's not just blabbering at this point. So, like, I want to read like two paragraphs. Like, I want to read this opening paragraph with it, which I feel like is firmly grounding us in this moment. And then I want to read this other paragraph where I feel like it goes totally off base and is one of those like sort of gold coins. But this first opening paragraph, I was like, oh, okay, I got it. I'd been staying at the Holiday Inn with my girlfriend, honestly, the most beautiful woman I'd ever known, for 3 days under a phony name, shooting heroin. We made love in the bed, ate steaks at the restaurant, shot up in the John, puked, cried, accused one another, begged of one another, forgave, promised, and carried one another to heaven. So there's like that moment at the end, like carried one another to heaven. Okay, cool. But then this other paragraph, and then came one of those moments. I remember living through one when I was 18 and spending the afternoon in bed with my first wife before we were married. Our naked bodies started glowing and the air turned such a strange color. I thought my life must be leaving me. And with every young fiber and cell, I wanted to hold on to it for another breath. A clattering sound was tearing up my head as I staggered upright and opened the door on a vision I will never see again. Where are my women now with their sweet, wet words and ways and the miraculous balls of hail popping in a green translucence in the yards? We put on our clothes, she and I, and walked out into a town flooded ankle deep with white, buoyant stones. Birth should have been like that. To me, this is like almost a wild tangent. He's remembering hail, I guess because of this moment before where he talks about like having popped Wayne's head like an egg. I don't know. I don't know where it comes from. And he's thinking about these women, specifically his first wife. And this, I think, is a good example of the type of thing where he's trying to describe what it was like for you. But he was even probably messed up then. And so the way it's coming to him is in these strange glimpses. But point being, I feel like the opening paragraph of this story feels like it firmly grounds you in what's happening. He's like, I was on a bender with my girlfriend in a hotel room for 3 days. And then this is talking about a moment in bed with his first wife. It's an afternoon during a hailstorm, but he also seems kind of messed up. And then it all ends in that line, which I loved and underlined, where it said, birth should have been like that. I don't know. I think these are the types of sort of tangents or...
He's making connections, right?
He is, yeah.
We just talked about him being disconnected, but as a narrator, he's making these connections. But he's making connections between moments. There's like a tradition of what is the sublime amongst fiction. Like, I forget who, some Roman talked about stories. It's one of the points of good stories is like glimpsing the sublime.
Okay.
But this moment of coming out of the hotel into that new world that was created by the hailstorm, and he says birth should have been like that. That's like entering into a new world, right? But the moment at the bar after the fight was nearly averted was like the green silence after the hailstorm. He's literally saying like, that's what this is like. It's like this moment where just everything's still and you're kind of like, everything's changed. Everything's different now. Because Wayne starts this fight that no one's willing to carry through, but he wins the moment somehow. It just changes the whole dynamics of the poker game because he stares down somebody who he should not have been able to stare down.
Right. Who would have kicked his ass.
Yeah. But because it changes everything, like that's how he makes that connection between those two moments. And it's like you try to capture the sublime in something. Like that is a pivotal, important moment, bigger than it should be. It's like you're approaching something awesome, like something full of awe. In fiction, you can describe a scene, but to get that feeling, how do you capture that feeling? How do you capture that the character is feeling something so much bigger than you can put on the page? And it's by making those kinds of connections, by making those kinds of analogies, right?
Yeah, I forgot sort of what preceded that scene. I just remember it standing out mostly for that final line. But yeah, you're right. He is using it to like describe the feeling of the bar after that missed fight, but also what other way can he describe it, right? It's such a hard thing to pinpoint. And so he has to sort of draw this connection to another time when he felt it, which is going to be another.
Yeah. There's not a word for this feeling. There's only those other times I've felt this feeling. Let me tell you about that. I think that's like a common thing in stories. And it's when it's done well, it really highlights those moments for you. It's like even the dinosaur story that we were talking about before we started recording, because it draws a connection between the beginning and the end of his life. You have that feeling right there. I'm glad our conversation led us to that, because I think that is the essence of the kind of voice that I wanted to find for the project.
I also didn't really know what to make of the end here.
Similar to Car Crash, right?
Yeah, yeah. So right after the scene where he compares it to the hailstorm, so there's the fight in the bar, and then he's just kind of like talking about how generous the bartender was that day. I like this section where it says, all the really good times happened when Wayne was around, but this afternoon somehow was the best of all those times. We had money, we were grimy and tired. Usually we felt guilty and frightened because there was something wrong with us and we didn't know what it was, but today we had the feeling of men who had worked. I really like that section. Whether or not you are living the kind of life these two men are, where they're just trying to get their next fix, you know, and they feel like they're running from something. I do love the sentiment and the way they've described having done work that day, especially manual labor. Like, you feel like you've earned whatever it is that comes next for you. They've earned those beers. They've earned that generosity. They did an honest day's work, and they don't only earn it because it's the first honest day's work they've done in a while. It's just, I feel like anyone that does that kind of labor repeatedly even feels like at the end of the day, that's what you've earned is rest, you know, and relaxation and like some kind of indulgence. And I like that part. But then the next paragraph just like is describing whatever else is happening here. And then it says, I'll never forget you. Your husband will beat you with an extension cord and the bus will pull away, leaving you standing there in tears. But you were my mother. It's like, what?
That's the you. And that is he's addressing the server, right?
The one server, whose name he doesn't
generously
remember.
Pours the drink, right? Because this is one of those cool things, because it's like a memoir style kind of thing, but he's like years later he spotted her and he recognized her and he's like, oh yeah, it's that one, and can't remember her name, but
that was a good day.
That was a great day. You're like the icing on the top of that day.
Yeah,
because I mean, he says you were my mother, right? But earlier the other passage you read ends with birth should have been like that, right?
Yeah,
so there's
yeah,
this
yeah.
connection of imagery of creation, of like she's helping him get into this new world.
Yeah, and she's doing it in a way that's kind and comforting and full of wonder. He's like watching her serve him and he's just like, this is incredible.
Yeah, so some advice to draw from that is if you find a good image, carry that image through the whole thing, return to it, bring it out in other moments in your story.
I mean, are we also then supposed to assume that when he's talking about like being beaten with an extension cord and left at a bus stop, or well, taken away by a bus stop, I mean, that for me was that first
that's an
scene.
Echo. Yeah,
yeah. And I guess he's saying like, I don't know, I was reading that kind of thinking like the world's gonna going to be cruel to you, specifically other men, but like right now.
See, it's a little confusing.
I don't know.
One of the confusions about this story is that he gets on the bus to leave his wife because he's upset with her. And then he gets off the bus and goes to the Vine where he meets Wayne. And then all this stuff happens. And then they go back to the Vine where the server is that he remembers. So the wife never comes back into the story except by proxy with this server, right?
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
She's never named either, right? The wife. So he doesn't remember the server's name and he never mentions her name. A lot of parallels there.
I guess the other thing I'll say is that, like, even though, like, as you'll, of course, realize as you're hearing me talk about this, I wasn't necessarily totally aware of what was happening in each of these scenes. You know, like, he hurts his girlfriend slash wife, whoever this girl is, girlfriend. She disappears. He gets on the bus. He goes to the bar. His friend says, you want to do some work? They go rip the copper out of his house. And then they go back to the bar and they have a really nice afternoon because they're getting drunk again and they have money. Like, that's the story. But in terms of these other comparisons and metaphors that he's making or connections he's drawing so that he can articulate the feelings of those days, that's where it gets sort of blurry for me, you know? But I think I'm still 85% there. And the reason why I'm willing to read this and why I'll remember this story is because it was so fun to read each of those sentences. Each of them took you on a ride. His style and his voice is just unmatched. And I remember feeling that way about the crash too. Just, I don't know totally what's happening here, but this is pretty exciting to read because you kind of just, you don't know what's going to happen next. And it's not just the plot itself, but it's where his brain makes the connections and where he decides he's going to tell you about a past memory. Like, it all feels really alive and like anything could happen next, you know?
There's a few writers that we've done stories of on the podcast, like Laurie Moore, Lauren Groff, Nabokov, and Dennis Johnson has also those lines that are just like, so they're like little spears that just get right into the heart of things. But when I was reading the passage, I could have stopped one sentence earlier because he asks him, who owned these houses, do you think? He stopped doing anything. This is my house. It is? It was. Easily could have stopped there. But the next line, he gave the wire a long, smooth yank, a gesture full of the serenity of hatred, popping its staples and freeing it into the room. I was like, I can't not read that line.
Can't give that one up. Yeah, that's how it feels to pick a section because, which darling do you want to kill when each of these sentences feels that exciting and that alive and sort of like worth pointing out? A lot of times I feel like, especially even in my own writing, even if I'm on like a real kick and everything I'm doing feels really good and exciting and alive, like I said at the start, I was trying to capture a certain voice when I started this last short story and then I'm like, wow, here it is again. It's Christine's voice, you know? Turns out I can only do one thing. I feel like even some of the best writers, even when they're doing some of these really fun, exciting things and each sentence is exciting and you're following, I feel like even these writers will have to kind of pause and give you narration that explains what's going to happen next, where you'll have like a really fun passage, like the one with the hailstorm, and then the next paragraph for a different writer might be something like, Wayne and I were sitting next to each other at the bar when the bartender poured us a very generous shot, and it would sort of ground you again. It would sort of like clear your throat sort of, and it's always like a new paragraph where they let you get your bearings again. And I feel like this story doesn't really do that. It's like tumbling down the hill and there's no catching your breath.
Kind of does. I mean,
but even when it does it the way he wants to do it, which is way more fun than what I would do. What I would do would be like, all right, I gotta remind people where these characters are physically. And then you'd read it and you'd be like, oh, where'd that voice go? It disappeared for a minute because Christine had to do a thing to explain something, you know? And he's just kind of like, I'm not even gonna bother with that. Yes, I'm explaining. I understand the points of a story and like what I need to do to keep people engaged, but I don't even have to do that part in a boring way.
Okay, so they do the house thing. They go to the bar. The server is there who's generous with their pours. And then he's contemplating Wayne, right? Because Wayne says, he's like, I'm buying. And Wayne's like, no way in hell. Wayne says, it is, Wayne said, my sacrifice. And the narrator's like, sacrifice? I've already gotten a word like sacrifice. Certainly, I had never heard of it. And then he goes into, let me tell you about Wayne. But he doesn't say, let me tell you about Wayne. It's, I'd seen Wayne look across the poker table in a bar and accuse. I do not exaggerate it. Then he goes on and talks him about, he gets into that stare down that doesn't actually culminate in a fight when it should have. But halfway, not even halfway, almost all the way through that, the man shook his head. He sat down too. This was an amazing thing. By reaching out one hand and taking hold of it for 2 or 3 seconds, he could have popped Wayne's head like an egg. And then came one of those moments. So this is like a transition sentence because now he's embedding a further thing inside of it. it. I remember living through one when I was 18, because he's like, this is a moment, but let me tell you about another one that kind of helps you understand this moment. And they talked about the hailstorm thing. And when he gets done with the hailstorm thing, his birth should have been like that. The next paragraph is, that moment in the bar after the fight was narrowly averted was like the green silence after the hailstorm. So he's reminding you, like, we're going back to the bar. But there's a reason I just told you about the hailstorm, because this is, we're feeling the same thing, right? Somebody was buying a round of drinks. Cards were scattered on the table. So it's like the aftermath. It's like walking out into the hailstones all over the ground is similar to like the cards being scattered on the table in the aftermath of some dramatic reorientation of the world's axes. And then ends it by saying, Wayne was a part of all that. Next paragraph. The vine was like a railroad club car that had somehow run itself off the tracks into the swamp. And we're back into the aftermath of the work. We're back into where the server is pouring. So it's not all, there's some moments where he's giving us clues, but the exit from it is just right back into the scene.
Maybe that's a better way to see how it happens. I guess it's sort of like when someone thinks that they're gonna hit the easy button on a book and they're gonna write an entire novel where it's two characters writing letters to each other. And they're like, oh, this will be easy.
Oh yeah, I don't need any interstitials.
And people will try that in a workshop and you're like, yeah, this is garbage. It's because there's something, it's hard to tell when you're reading this how much work is going into it. But if you know anything about what it's like to try to do this kind of writing, it's impossible. So the fact that he can at once ground you in something, but like have these moments where, you know, you're having to work as the reader to understand the connections, not in a way that you're completely confused, but where you feel like it's operating like slightly above your level of understanding or consciousness even, right? You have to like embody this mindset in a way. You have to understand this character fully and like be along for the ride. You might read this story and think, oh, I can write about like what it's like to be high. That's what the guy that wrote this book that I had to stop reading thought he could do. He thought he could write about what it was like to be high, just carry you along for 300 pages. You can't do it. But when you can do it, it's like he makes it seem effortless and he makes it seem like it's accomplished because the character is high or something. But that's not true. This is being written by someone of like with a firm grasp on storytelling. Even if he's thwarting some of the rules and changing some of the ways that he's doing it, he's able to break the rules because he understands it.
So the way our minds work in general is there's different modes of thought. Like you can think with images, you can think with other things, and you can think with language, you can think with words and like structured sentences. Like you can look out your front door and think, why are they doing that? Oh, I see. He's gonna unload that thing out of the truck and oh, they must be doing that. So there's like this connections that are made, and like you can follow like a train of thought in that way. And I always think of any kind of prose, like writing, as creating a train of thought. And so the connections don't always have to be explicit, but they have to be, there's something in between the sentences. Sometimes the connections are as explicit as like that moment in the bar after the fight was narrowly averted was like the green silence after the hailstorm. He tells us, this is my realization in the moment. I realized that this moment in the bar is the same as when we dealt with a hailstorm. Or even that one, Wayne was a part of all that. That's the thought connecting, making the backwards connection. So as a writer, your job is to write out the sentences in a way that guides the reader's thought process. This is why I don't like giving prose feedback in the workshop. People like to rewrite other people's sentences. You can't do that because everyone's sentences are so different and there's no right way to write any sentence. Like you can offer all kinds of suggestions, but the most important part of that kind of editing work or revision work is not how each sentence says the thing. It's how this sentence leads to the next sentence and how the previous sentence led to that sentence. And so that's why it's futile to try to rewrite an individual sentence within the story unless you're taking into account everything that comes after and comes before, which is the job of the writer.
Yeah, I think when I have the urge to line edit, like you said, it's only when things are being told in a pretty straightforward way that you can maybe hope to help there, you know? And otherwise you are like interrupting a creative process that kind of ruins the whole thing.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I don't still have that urge.
Well, I don't think some writers think that way. And sometimes you do have to point out like this sentence doesn't work. I try to like just draw an arrow, like what's the connection from here to here? And then a question mark, just to signal that you got to think about these things. You sent me something to look over. It wasn't even fiction, but there was a little thing that I hesitate over. It's like, why is she using this word in this place? And I was like, well, she didn't want to repeat. You're about to use a different word in the next sentence. So you didn't want to repeat that word and have it in two different different sentences.
So if you can anticipate that, yeah.
But my thought was, but I don't like that first sentence. I was like, I need to give feedback on the sentence because that felt like a hiccup. And so I realized we can just delete it. You don't have to mention it at all.
Yes.
But that's because it's coming up later. You can do that. You can't do that if it's like in isolation. Then you would have to use the other word.
When I do onboarding calls with people in the workshop, I still default to wherever it is you came up with it or where you heard it. The idea that individuals in the workshop when they're giving feedback should be really descriptive in terms of their reaction to a piece, but not prescriptive in terms of how to fix it, because that's when we get into trouble. And I don't think that most people, especially in conversations that we're having, are defaulting to line editing, but certainly in their markups on the page, you know, they feel that way. And that's what you really have to be careful about is, I've said it maybe like twice where we've had a really raw writer come in and you could tell they're not super experienced, but you don't want to interrupt at all the development of their voice. You can see it happening on the page. And it's not just people that decide that they're not going to capitalize a single letter. You know, there's some people that are taking big artistic swings, you know, and it's like, I don't know if this is going to pan out. I might tell you to use quotes in your dialogue because this is really confusing. But there's certain types of writers when you could tell they're not trying something, but they're trying to figure themselves out. And that's when you don't want to interrupt. And that's when you don't want other amateur writers trying to give advice. Like, imagine if this story came into our workshop setting and like people that wrote straightforward stuff and not well were like, listen, Dennis, were you high when you wrote this? This didn't make any sense.
I think he specifically said that he did not write it high. He said something like...
He probably has to say that in every interview.
His line is funny because it was something like, no, I didn't write it high because when you're high, your hands get really big. How could you even type with giant hands? Something like that.
And the interviewer's like, wow, drugs are wild. I've never had one. I feel like we both have the same takeaway about like a type of voice, but that was really all I could come up with this. And I always do this anytime I'm writing anything, I relate anything I'm reading at the moment to like how it can improve what I'm currently writing. It's not that they're directly related or anything, but here at least, this feels like the type of energy and excitement. I want to infuse this kind of excitement into my own writing. And sometimes it's maybe trusting your reader, you know? I don't know that Dennis Johnson spent a whole lot of time worrying about whether his readers would understand what was happening, so much as describing it the way he wants to describe it, taking you on the journey he wants you to have. And like I said, having a firm grasp and understanding of how you tell a story. But sometimes I feel a little restrained in my writing. I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, okay, how do I get to the next part? Instead of just seeing where the story itself sort of takes you or where you feel like it might be exciting to go. Yeah, that's sort of my takeaway. And I think too, when I read fun stuff like this, I can't help but sort of mimic it the next time I sit down and write my own stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, how can I make my own stuff more fun, more exciting?
My takeaway is kind of similar, but I have to caveat it because I think voice is the worst metaphor writers I've ever come up with for what happens sure. in a piece of fiction, because I don't think this is a voice. It has nothing to do with Dennis Johnson's speech styles or anything, because speech styles can be mimicked. And this is not like the grammar of it, the word choice of it, the kind of ebb and flow of it are not unique to him. I've read this voice by other writers, but I think what it is a way of approaching things. It's almost like it's perspective is probably the better way. And that might be because I've come to the conclusion that perspective is the heart of everything that is fiction.
Okay.
Like if you're telling a story, you're telling a story from a certain point of view, and point of view rules every decision you're going to make about what you're writing. And those are not unique to people either. But I think stories should have perspective and voice in those ways, not authors. By choosing a voice and choosing a perspective, you're choosing the kind of story you're going to tell. So my takeaway from this, my literal takeaway from this, is thinking about the story I want to write and how that voice/perspective would best tell that story, irrespective of my own writing tics or writing shortcuts that I always fall into. Ultimately, if I were a better writer, I wouldn't fall into them. I would write what the story needs and not express it in like the way that is me. Like I want to express the story, not me, if that makes sense. But all that being said, he has as a writer, he's got a very distinctive way of putting things together, and can learn a lot from that about our own ways of putting things together. So in that way, it's the same as your takeaway. The podcast is going to be audio only, so you're not going to see Christine resting her head on her hand.
Sometimes you say things and I'm like, dude, I'm such a fucking idiot. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, number one, I'm an idiot. And number two, wait a second, I want to change what I just said. Edit it, edit it. No, what I'm going to say is, okay, thanks, guys. And then I'm going to say, if you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.